morning. The first case set for argument is appeal number 30558, Lonnie Two Eagle Sr. versus Abel E-Care et al. For appearing and arguing on behalf of Mr. Two Eagle is John LaFleur. And Matthew Murphy will be arguing on behalf of Abel. And then we also have Sarah Frankenstein who will be arguing on behalf of Moonlighting Solution Services. And I understand, Mr. Murphy and Ms. Frankenstein, you've divided up your time, 8 minutes for Mr. Murphy and 7 for Ms. Frankenstein. Okay. With that, then, Mr. LaFleur, you may proceed with your initial argument.
May it please the court, counsel. Defendants owed a duty of reasonable care to Mr. Two Eagle, who was foreseeably put at risk of injury by Dr. Smith's negligent failure to follow the safety restriction which had been issued on April 16, 2019, directing his patient no driving until seizure-free for 6 months. On June 23, 2019, only 98 days later, Dr. Smith carelessly miscommunicated that his patient had been seizure-free for 6 months and authorized driving beginning in August, when Dr. Smith knew or should have known that 6 months had not passed since the April 11, 2019 seizures, and wouldn't pass until October 11 of 2019.
Counsel, can you help us with maybe laying out specifically your theory of duty? Because you make an argument that relates to both whether this is ordinary negligence and not malpractice at all, and you seem to also be making an argument if it is malpractice, here's how you get to duty. Can you lay that out for us? What is your primary argument, or how do you arrive at duty here?
As the court knows, the touchstone of legal duty is foreseeability of injury. That's from Summers versus Thompson and numerous other cases. So, and there's not a great difference between malpractice and ordinary negligence, but there's substantial evidence, Your Honor, that Dr. Smith was negligent, and there's substantial evidence that on April 16th, he was told that his patient had suffered 8 witness seizures, 7 of which happened between March.
Those are all negligence. What the duty question is what she was asking you to focus on.
Well, the duty arises from the foreseeability of injury. On April 16th, Dr. Smith was told that his patient had 8 witness seizures in a month time frame before he was seen on April 16th. The last of those seizures were April 11th. Just 5 days before he saw his patient. And that foreseeability of risk that he was told about, obviously the reason that Dr. Smith entered the restriction, the driving restriction, no driving until seizure-free for 6 months, is because he was concerned that his patient would be injured and those he would encounter on the roadway or near the roadway would be injured if he were to suffer a seizure while driving.
So go ahead, please.
So if foreseeability is, if we give you that, and that's all that duty is about, here we're talking about a third party to the doctor-patient relationship. I think our cases require more than just, well, it could be foreseeable or it is foreseeable, that there could be some harm if this guy is driving with a risk of having a seizure. Doesn't it require some sort of a relationship, either a special relationship between either the actor, the doctor here in this case, and the third party, or between the patient and the third party? Or isn't there some requirement that maybe the doctor increased the risk by doing something? I mean, those seem to be the instances where we've created some sort of third party or recognized the possibility of that. But is there any of that in this case?
Well, this court recognized that it wasn't the relationship that creates the duty. It is the foreseeability of injury. And that's from Thompson versus Summers, 1997, South Dakota 103. What this court said.
Is that a third-party duty case?
It is a third-party duty case in that the operator of the balloon created a rescue situation and someone tried to help. So there was no relationship between the balloon operator and the injured person. So in this court, in the motorist setting outside the medical context, has upheld third party responsibility duty in Harris versus Best Business Products, in Keel versus Horner Lumber, and in McGuire versus Curry.
So, Mr. LaFleur, if I could please, there's a number of courts, a number of commentators, Prosser among them, have described a court's determination of whether a duty exists, whether someone will be held and subjected to liability and held to the standard of law as judicial policymaking. And they hold that it's not just a question of foreseeability. Foreseeability is part of it. But there are any number of other factors that go into the determination of whether a person, a party, will be subjected to the law or the standard of the law or subjected to liability for an alleged violation of the law. What about those policy considerations here? It's one of those few instances where courts sort of say, well, is it a good policy or is it a bad policy? And a number of things are weighed. And those have been raised in the briefs. Can you address some of those policy concerns?
Certainly, Your Honor. The primary issues raised by the defendants as far as South Dakota public policy is that opening third-party duty to a non-patient would affect the physician-patient relationship. They say that the doctors will be more concerned about liability from third parties rather than focusing on the care for their patient.
That seems to be one of them. Yeah, what do you think about that?
But in our case, this is a very narrow duty that we're asking. It's not wide, all-encompassing. We're not dealing with medical decision-making in this case. We're not dealing with a failure to warn. This is a narrow pattern where the doctor had identified the risk, the foreseeability of injury.
You know, sometimes our cases say that we have foreseeability as a component of duty, and sometimes we have it as a foreseeability as a component of breach. And it's maybe kind of tough, I suppose, for all of us who read those cases to determine which one is which. Sometimes when I hear that argument that, you know, doctor should have known about this, should have understood that this was a risk, I wonder, as the chief suggested, does that seem to pour over into foreseeability as a component to breach? In other words, the duty is can this doctor be subjected to liability for this conduct? And foreseeability is part of that, but there are other concerns.
Well, I would point the court to the case of Doe versus Cochran, a 2019 Connecticut case, which is most similar to our case in that case, there was a miscommunication of some STD testing. And in our case, there was miscommunication of calculating when 6 months had passed. So in that case, the court looked at all of the public policy reasoning and addressed those public policy reasons. The court indicated...
But in that case, that was a different case. There was an identifiable victim in that case, wasn't there?
In that particular case? Setting with the STD testing, there was. But our court has addressed that other motorists and pedestrians are included as protected third parties in those cases that I said, in Harris versus Best Business, in McGuire versus Curry, in Keel versus Horner. The court allowed third party duty in those situations. So
counsel, would there be any limiting principle on the rule statement regarding the extent of the foreseeability? Would doctors then be required at some level to have to supervise their patients, for example?
Not based on this case, Your Honor, because it's limited to that very narrow duty that's being created when the doctor failed or violated his own restriction that he put on driving. Here's how in dealing with the issue of ordinary negligence, the Connecticut court in Doe versus Cochran determined that plaintiff's cause of action sounded in ordinary negligence. The alleged error was not one involving professional medical judgment. If defendant misread the lab result when the doctor failed to perform a simple ministerial task, no advanced medical training was necessary to determine that the patient had a positive test. Lay people routinely perform comparable tasks.
Okay, counsel, so in this case, it seems like it's a little bit more than just inaccurate reporting or failure to read a report. It was also a directive based on a medical judgment that related to what would be reported or what was in the not reviewed in terms of whether or not he was safe to drive. So it seemed like there was another step in this one that wasn't where it was dull. You just reported a wrong result.
No. Dr. Smith, on April 16th, after hearing of these 7 seizures in the last month, he said, you should not be driving. That was determined on April 16th. The miscalculation, the error, was committed on July 23rd, 2019. There was no decision-making on July 23rd, 2019. The doctor simply miscalculated when 6 months had elapsed, and it wouldn't have elapsed until October. So there was no medical decision that was being made. It is just as simple as the misreading of the lab results in Doe versus Cochran.
So if we get beyond that, though, in Doe, the court did then go on to look at this, you know, how broad the class of foreseeability, should there still be restrictions on that for public policy reasons, correct?
Well, and in Doe versus Cochran, the court did address that this is a narrow duty that we're talking about because of the ministerial type of error that was made. The court indicated that the defendants have given no reason to think that the type of error that we're talking about in the instant case is so prevalent that it couldn't be curtailed by quality assurance. So the court in Doe versus Cochran recognized that it's a narrow duty issue, and likewise in this case, it's a very narrow duty issue that we're dealing with. And so this case isn't going to be an indication or a signal for future cases that there's widespread duty for doctors to warn. This doesn't mean that the doctors are always going to be responsible for failing to warn. This case doesn't have anything to do with medical decision making.
So let me ask you about that. How would you limit that? Because in this instance, if we say there's a duty, doesn't any time a doctor misdiagnoses or says, you know, you're free to go do this, and it turns out it was too early, doesn't that create potential liability? What's the limitation here?
Absolutely not, Your Honor, because there is no medical decision or medical judgment involved in this case. In those cases, then you're talking about decision-making and medical judgment. That's a totally different ball of wax. Our case is strictly a miscalculation, and the doctor did not focus on his patient's care, did not...
But isn't that all within the patient? I mean, that's all within the duty of a professional duty of a doctor to make sure I've read the notes right, I've looked at everything. I mean, it may be a very simple error that any layperson could look at and figure out if it's supposed to be 6 months. But nonetheless, it's all part of all tied up within the duty of professional obligation of a physician, isn't it?
The mistake that Dr. Smith made was miscalculating when 6 months elapsed.
But the premise, Mr. LaFleur, is that 6 months is set in stone, and it was the definitive restriction. It couldn't be varied, and the medical judgment had nothing to do with it. But I don't think that's right, probably, right? Medical judgment had a lot to do with whether 6 months was right or not right. And to really judge or to understand that allegation in terms of a duty, you have to have a premise that it was truly ministerial. But this comes that even if he violates that, or even if that's different than the 6 months, doesn't it depend upon the 6 months being something that is itself ministerial?
He didn't change from 6 months ever. He in his request for admissions, he acknowledged that, Your Honor. I see that my time has expired. Thank you.
Mr. Murphy, you can proceed with your argument.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Matt Murphy. I'm here on behalf of one of the appellees in this matter, Avell eCare. The question in front of you here today is an important one here in South Dakota, and it's an unanswered question. It's whether or not this court should extend a legal duty to place a legal duty upon a physician to keep in mind the general public when making care and treatment decisions for his or her patient. The circuit court analyzed the issue and concluded no, such a duty should not be placed upon medical providers in our state. And I would ask you on behalf of my client to affirm that decision today because that is the correct decision. I don't have much time, so I'm going to skip over the facts and jump straight to the legal analysis. Was there or was there not a duty, and what should be analyzed when considering whether or not to impose the duty here? There was a lot of talk about foreseeability when Mr. LaFleur was up here, but that ignores a critical part of the equation. In the Curlin versus Halverson case, this court noted public policy is a major consideration in identifying duty. We have numerous cases in this state where factual foreseeability could be found, but because of public policy, duty was not imposed.
When you say public policy, Mr. Murphy, do you in our cases, as you know, and the briefs have some of these cases cited, we have those cases where they say public policy is its decisions, its statutes, its common law, its whatever. Is that the kind of public policy you're talking about, or are you talking about only sort of statutory public policy? Or is a court free, in other words, to sort of say, you know what, this kind of is judicial policy making, like Prosser might have it or contemplate it?
Justice Salter, I think it's all of that. I think the court has to use the common sense judgment that it has available to it. It has to look at what other courts have done. It has to look at what our legislature has said on this topic. It has to look at the rulemaking bodies that our legislature has appointed power to on this issue. And here, for example...
So if that's the case, it may not be a hard line. In other words, it's really a totality of a number of things that you're looking at. You're looking at various interests in society. And so... It may not be a hard line. Doctors always has a duty, or doctor never has a duty to a third party.
Sure, and I don't believe this court needs to get to the point to say a doctor never has such a duty. That would be an advisory opinion. Look at this case, because there are other jurisdictions that have found exceptions to the rule. For example, when you have an identifiable third party victim, or when you have, in certain cases, a failure to warn, when you have a patient that comes in and gets particular medication that might cause them to black out, and the doctor never tells them a word about that. That's not this case. Mr. LaFleur freely admits this is not a failure to warn case. This is a case about a treatment decision and recommendation made to a patient who had a seizure disorder, knows that he has a seizure disorder.
If we don't recognize some sort of legal duty in this case, wouldn't that incentivize doctors to ignore the third-party harm that negligent treatment to a patient might cause?
I don't know that they need to be incentivized any more than they already are by this court, because they're, the way that doctors are trained from the day they enter medical school is patient interests above all others, above their own, above the general public, period. So then they get out into the workforce in South Dakota and they look at the administrative rules. What does our administrative rule tell them? A physician shall, while caring for a patient, regard responsibility to the patient as paramount. Our administrative rules then adopt the AMA Code of Ethics. In the opinion 1.1.1, the physician-patient relationship gives rise to the physician's ethical responsibility to place patients' welfare above the physician's own self-interest or obligations to others. So the patient's interest has to be paramount, and creating the duty that appellants suggest drives a wedge between that relationship where a physician needs to make treatment decisions and treatment recommendations with not just what's best for this patient in front of me here today, what does the medical standard of care dictate I do to protect or to serve or to provide medical care to this patient to the best of my ability, what is this going to do when this patient walks out the door? And that's where we come into some of these cases that this court has previously found where a defendant has a duty to protect a plaintiff from a third party. Some of the cases that Mr. LaFleur cited, a lot of those cases involve situations where a defendant has a duty or an ability to control the third party.
That's that. That's Curlin, and that's that 315, 16, 17, 20 of the Restatement Second, those sections.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. Yes. And here, the second that a patient walks out the clinic door or the hospital door, that physician has no ability to control that patient's interactions with the general public. Did that patient listen to their medical advice? Did that patient take the medication that they were prescribed? Did that patient drink before driving? Did that patient stop taking his or her seizure medication, which is an issue that we have in this case? So we have no ability or duty to control, yet appellant is suggesting that that issue should be ignored and the duty should still be extended up to a physician. And this is something that was specifically noted in the Prazel case from Texas. In that case, the Texas Supreme Court noted that of the inability to control what a patient does and does not do in interacting with the public is a big problem because patients often don't listen to their doctors. So we're exposing doctors to liability for interactions their patients are having with the public when they have no ability to control it.
So it seems like under, you know, that applying that restatement provision, you know, so that's one route. And if we were to agree, it doesn't fit here that the doctor does not have a duty to control the patient. Then the other route is whether there's this special relationship with the other, with the victim that ultimately happened because of something. And is that something where there is a foreseeable risk of harm to somebody that's identifiable or something in that regard? It seems like that's the other avenue, potential avenue, and then you get into the public policy.
Yes.
Is that a fair way to analyze it?
Because when you look at it that way, that's when the public policy becomes injected into the analysis, and then you start talking about the special relationship between a physician and their patient, and should that be impacted by far-reaching foreseeability concepts.
And as I understand what you've started out saying is that you are suggesting we don't need to decide that, you know, for all circumstances, but to look at that scenario here, and what do we have here?
What do we have in this case? What are the facts presented? It's not a failure to warn case. We've got a situation where a doctor made treatment decisions, and then his patient went out and got into a motor vehicle accident. He didn't do it. It wasn't a failure to warn. There wasn't an identifiable third-party victim. So it's not that type of case. I would say, though, however, that finding the duty that the appellant suggests will mushroom into a number of other pieces of litigation that medical providers in our state, which is already stressed to recruit medical providers, especially to areas like where this accident happened, would create problems in that scenario.
Of course, this doctor is not from that area. He's from Georgia.
Nonetheless, there's still contracts, and that's why they have to do telemedicine.
Yeah.
My time is up. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Frankenstein, you may proceed with your argument.
May it please the court, counsel. Again, I'm Sarah Frankenstein. I represent Dr. Smith and his placement agency, Moonlight Solutions. I'd like to speak a little bit more to what duty really means here and the question, which is a good one, with regard to when do the facts matter? When do the facts of the case become relevant to a legal duty, the foreseeability that informs the legal duty, the legal question, as opposed to whether a duty has been breached, an issue for the jury? This is important because the case law is confusing a bit in this area. So as we've briefed, legal duty can be created three ways. First is by statute. I'd like to touch on that one quickly. Statute has, in fact, created a legal duty as to who is in charge, who makes the decision with regard to who can drive. That responsibility has been squarely placed upon the shoulders of the Department of Public Safety by our legislature. The DPS gets to determine who can and should be licensed to drive, and the physicians have zero participation in that process. Statutes also require insurance for drivers, insurance for uninsured drivers. There's the numerous things that we've briefed, but notably what statute does not do is create a duty on a doctor to protect against or prevent what their patients do to members of the public. So in a vacuum of any statutory duty placed upon doctors here and those statutes squarely placing the responsibilities elsewhere, we can move on to the second thing that can create a legal duty, and that's the common law. That was discussed quite a bit here. It shouldn't be glossed over, although it's already been discussed, but that is very important because the public policy questions come into play there. The third is foreseeability, just one of three considerations that this court must determine when placing a legal duty. One thing to be noted is that opposing counsel discussed the facts at issue as to whether Dr. Smith could foresee a patient of his having a seizure and crashing into someone else. But whether a legal duty exists can never depend on contested facts. That is a legal question for this court. It is a legal question for the circuit court to instruct the jury what law applies, what legal duty applies. It cannot be left to the jury to sort through the contested facts in order for the jury to determine whether what the law is and how it applies.
That might be a little contrary to some of our cases. Don't we have some cases that talk about duty may in some instances be a fact question? And I don't have it in front of me, but I think we've got some cases that talk about it being a question of fact in some instances where facts are disputed.
I think more appropriately the question is whether the duty was breached, and I do think that can be fact intensive. We're here on a summary judgment appeal, so the court did have the facts before her.
So the Ross case, for one, that Lagow versus Ross, for one, is a case that talks about that factual nature, but just because it's just continuing the discussion, just because it's a fact question doesn't mean it's a jury question. There could be instances, I think, and I think Ross stands for that proposition, that there could be instances where courts, in the exercise of their duty to determine as a legal matter whether a duty exists, have to resolve facts. That may be the case. Does that make any sense?
I agree. I think that's exactly right. In this situation, so not propelling foreseeability as the one and only or the most important consideration, but understanding where the statutes place duty, what the common law has to say. One of the most important things I'd like to stress here today is that when we have the American Medical Association rules of ethics that govern physicians, they can be hauled before their licensing committee should they violate them. When we have administrative rules of South Dakota that enshrine those very ethics in our administrative rules, and we have the overarching requirement for doctors to put their patients' welfare paramount to anyone else's interests.
Is it a matter of sort of a, I'm reluctant to say a standard of care because I think that's not exactly what we're talking about, but is there any talismanic significance to the six-month restriction?
So going to the facts of the case, which the court would not need to weigh in on to ultimately determine the case, 6 months isn't a magical standard.
Forgive me for, I'm so sorry for interrupting, but it seems like it's a matter of logic. If the argument is that not abiding by that 6 month restriction is itself, evidence of this non-medical you know, sort of duty to just follow the 6 months. I'm curious about whether the 6 months is really set in stone. As if it's not, then the underlying premise seems like a medical judgment.
You're right on. I heard opposing counsel say that the doctor violated his own restriction put on driving. Doctors don't create their own legal duty. The court does. We can't have every doctor who puts a restriction, a prescription, some advice, and then changes it later, because of course a doctor can. We can't have that doctor creating his own legal duty by which he cannot violate it. That has no place in the legal determination as to the legal duty that doctor has to the patient. This court should not force physicians to somehow choose between violating their ethical standards and being hauled before their licensing board with their livelihood at stake, or violating a duty to the general public and being hauled before a jury with their pocketbook at stake. When we have ethical obligations that physicians must abide by that says patients' welfare is paramount, the court should not create a contrary legal duty requiring otherwise. That creates an untenable legal situation for our medical providers in our state.
So if the 6 months is within medical judgment, but let's look at this from an ordinary negligence perspective. So the calculation of the time, isn't that a ministerial duty that would be outside the medical expertise, something that a jury could determine?
No, because the underlying premise of that is medical judgment. For that doctor to say, I'd like you to not drive for 6 months, the doctor can and will at any time change that. He can say, I've found that your seizures are provoked. They're provoked by your drug use. Stop doing that and you'll be fine. Or I find that Keppra, the pharmaceutical at issue here, is stopping your seizures. You can start to drive now. I'm comfortable that they've been stopped. There's no magic between 6 months in particular or any dictate or suggestion a doctor gives his patient. Doctors cannot create a legal duty, and they certainly can't create it case by case, patient by patient. My time is up. Thank you.
Mr. LaFleur, you can proceed with rebuttal.
The doctor never changed his determination as to what was reasonable for his patient to not drive for 6 months. That never changed. It is subject to discretion, but in this case, the facts were he decided it's 6 months so that we can monitor this man, see if he's complying with his dosage, see if he's doing anything outside with other drugs that would affect things, making sure that the drugs are of the right dosage and are working for him. So that's why he set 6 months.
But that's his legal, that's the exercise of his medical judgment, it seems like. It could have been 5 or 6 or 7, or he could have changed it. It seems like that's right. Is that not right?
It's not right that he changed it.
No, he could have. See, because the idea is that he's setting his own duty, right? The law doesn't set that. He says, look, it's 6 months.
And he's determined what is safe for his patient, which all doctors do.
One of the things that, shifting gears, one of the things that some of the cases say that courts can look at in this effort is other means by which an aggrieved plaintiff can receive compensation. That's somewhat in this case. I looked at it in the briefs in any event, that your client was able to pursue other claims against other defendants in connection with these injuries. Can we consider that? Is that important? Does that go into the mix, or should we not think of that?
Well, it's collateral source.
Well, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about it in terms of determining whether there's a duty. Again, sort of looking at this, hey, are we going to extend this duty? One of the questions might be, well, if we don't extend the duty, can the plaintiff have any hope of recovery against anybody?
Well, I don't think it's fair to Mr. Two Eagle to preclude his cause of action because of these collateral sources.
So my question was, though, is it fair? Can we? No. Is it permissible as a legal matter, one of those policy considerations that we could consider?
I don't think it's fair that it has sufficient weight to preclude a cause of action. The trial court referred to Section 324A Restatement second of torts, the gratuitous undertaking, and determined that Dr. Smith set this six-month no-drive restriction and then violated it, and for that reason denied the motion to dismiss because there were sufficient facts to let the case proceed. Those facts never changed through discovery. They even got worse from the defendant's standpoint. And what the Connecticut court said about the ordinary negligence argument was that our courts have long recognized that a healthcare provider may commit ordinary negligence as opposed to malpractice in the course of treating a patient or providing medical services. We must review closely the circumstances under which the alleged negligence occurred. And that's what we're asking this court to do, is look closely at how the alleged negligence occurred in this case. And they determined that the cause of action sounded in ordinary negligence, and that here the same analysis applies as to the alleged wrong that occurred. It was a ministerial task of Dr. Smith carelessly indicating that 6 months had elapsed, which violated his own determination that we better watch this guy, monitor him for 6 months to make sure that he's going to be able to drive safe. And he released him 5 days later. After he released him, after August, this horrendous accident happens where Mr. Teagle's operating a riding lawnmower and suffers these catastrophic injuries. A man, a traditional Lakota man that had worked his entire life, had served his country, received a hardship discharge when his brother was killed in Vietnam. This man is a deserving man, and we request this court to please reverse the trial court's summary judgment determination and give this man his day in court.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.